Unsolved Mysteries Rewind is a commercial-free podcast that focuses on cases featured on the television show Unsolved Mysteries. Each episode features a single case and, if possible, updates and an expansion on the original story. Listener discretion is advised for listeners who are sensitive to true crime details.
Tonight on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, two friends get together to discuss episodes of their favorite television show, Unsolved Mysteries. Will they find answers? Will anyone care? You may be able to solve a mystery.
Allison, she's a nostalgia blogger. How are you doing, Allison?
Good.
Yeah, welcome to the show. Wow, this is very exciting. We're talking about season one, episode 8 of Unsolved Mysteries. This originally had maybe, I mean, I don't know if you went down this rabbit hole, but the dates of airing can be very, very inconsistent. But the date I came up with, according to IMDb, is November 30th, 1988.
And I verify that on Wikipedia.
Do you want to talk about the...
a lot of people named Mark.
Yeah, there are, right? It's like, what is going on here?
I'm like, did I really pick this episode because of all the names?
So our first case starts off on December 11th, 1987, over in Gothenburg, Nebraska. It's called The Missing Mom. The name of the person who the focus is Christy Jo Nichols. She vanished on December 11th. She comes from a community. Did you look into the community at all?
I did. And I, you know, I saw the same thing that you saw about the population, and you showed that one house. And, you know, so I looked like I just, you know, it's a small town, you know, Midwest. And
yeah, according to Unsolved Mysteries, it has a strong sense of community of 3,000 in 2010, which is, of course, well over a decade ago. The population had boomed to a 3,574. I found a cute little house for $137,000, which wasn't so bad.
Yeah, it was cute. Yeah, I said, oh, yeah, I changed the colors. But then again, that's after you buy the house.
Right. This is a town that is a small town. So
yeah. They
even have a motto. According to Unsolved Mysteries, when a neighbor's in trouble, it becomes everybody's business, which seems a little bit like a threat.
Whether you want it to be or not.
Yeah. They claim that Christy Jo Nichols is a housewife, right? And when I think of housewife, I think of that's your main job. That's your function, right? But she also does work at a bar, we find out. So she married gas station worker Mark Nichols, which is our first Mark of the episode, when she was 19 years old. We don't really get in anything on Mark's age.
I thought he seemed older, but I wouldn't say too much older.
Yeah, Mark doesn't seem like the kind of guy I really want to sit down and talk to for very long. He's kind of a simple guy, I guess is the best way to describe his personality.
Yeah.
I don't think there's too much. They had two children.
Yes, they had a daughter soon after their marriage, but there was no month or year given. And then they had a son in April 1986. Little less than 2 years before she disappeared. So he was quite little.
Now, 10 days before she vanished, it became a little bit more apparent to hospitals and the public that her marriage was falling apart with Mark. She went to the hospital for treatment for an injury, so much for the town motto. They stepped away from this. We don't see anybody stepping up to help Christy, at least not reportedly so. But yeah, rumors kind of went around that it was a rough marriage and Christy received the brunt of many and had many strange injuries. Whatever strange injuries mean, it probably means a lot of a bloody lip, a bruise, who knows.
Did they mention something about burnt cigarettes? I swear I...
Yeah, Mark at some point is saying in a very monotone tone, the only time that he could have hurt her or had any physical alteration is when they were on their waterbed, which for reenactment purposes, of course, they did go out and get a waterbed.
Yes.
That's Unsolved Mysteries. Thank you.
Yeah, that's they're very thorough like that.
But she lurched at him and burnt him with a cigarette, and he threw her on the waterbed, spraining her wrist.
Yeah, her thumb got bent back.
Yeah, that was it.
Naturally.
Well, anyway, Christy goes missing. And we're just like, we have no idea what happened to her. Mark states that there are rumors going around that he chopped her up and put her in garbage bags and buried her at the dump.
But nobody checked the dump.
I'm going to assume people did check the dump, but it's not stated on Unsolved Mysteries that anybody checked the dump.
He is mad about the allegations. Oh my goodness.
He's not the most, he's not really too passionate when he speaks, but.
No, but like, you can tell at that point he's, you know, it's like, nerd.
Yeah, it was kind of, the whole thing was very strange. But, oh, and here's the quote. The only bad fight I can, and this is from Mark. The only bad fight I can remember is when I was trying to get her to stay home from going out. And she was getting so upset at me. And she started to try and hit and kick me. And that's when she burned the side of my neck with the cigarette she was holding. I tossed her onto the waterbed. And she landed wrong. And it twisted her thumb up underneath her. Thank you, Mark. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, up to this point, it really isn't that big of a deal. But the things that are going on behind the scenes, Christy at this point approached an attorney, an out-of-town attorney for a divorce.
Yes, yes. Looking at my notes right now to find the... We had a name in the notes, I think, of the attorney, right? Or no?
Let's see. Claude
Barrickman.
Claude ended up passing away back in 2013 at the age of 80.
Yes.
But but yeah, she was filing divorce, or she was trying to file for divorce based on the grounds of being attacked so many times of abuse. And this is something that we've discussed on Unsolved Mysteries a number of times. It's a well-known theory that the most dangerous time for a woman is when she's attempting to leave a man. And I'm not saying that Mark definitely did this, because, spoiler alert, Mark was exonerated from all of any involvement in her disappearance.
Yes, yes, he was.
But there's still more to talk about in this story, because can you talk about what he chose to do? His wife is missing, right? The mother to his two children is missing. Well, no, he decided to move. And he decided to sell their two cars.
Yes. It's everything that seems very, I hate to say it, it sounds suspicious. Yeah, he moved. He sold their cars. It's like he just moved on with his life and didn't really seem to, he lied to her mother.
Well, let me just say, so the night before she vanished, Mark and Christy decided to go out and have a night out. They hired a babysitter. Her name is Diane Jansen to watch her two children. And I'm thinking that what this was is to break the news. I'm going to sit down with Mark. I'm going to say it's time for us to split up. What I'm going to guess that happened, and this is all assumptions, is that he lost his mind and he killed her. Maybe.
But he said in the interview that it was a good night, that he had a good time, that they had a good time and didn't really. So it seems like there's two different stories.
Yeah, so when they return home, kind of late, but that's a good thing too. They're out, they're having a fun time. They went to a bar, and they return home between 12:30 and 1 a.m. Diane, the babysitter, was paid by Mark, which was weird because she normally gets paid by Christy.
Yes.
By check. She just thought it was weird. She does not recall seeing Christy physically that night come home.
Yes.
But at the same time, we're not really sure exactly what, I mean, people can just come into the house and, you know, you don't know their home. I mean, I don't know if I can totally state for sure that Diane's account is 100%.
Yes.
But the next morning, Mark claims to wake up and Christy is missing. Christy is nowhere to be found. He's kind of in a sort of panic.
Yeah.
He claims to have gone to sleep at 2 a.m. the night before. And
that was the last time he saw her.
Yeah. So on December 11th, which is the next morning, Christy is missing. And he claims that Christy left him and their children took a suitcase of belongings, which marks
very intimate knowledge of what was in that suitcase.
Right. He knows. It's almost like a checklist that he made and packed it. Oh, wait. No, I mean that Christy packed. He knows everything that's in this case, which is maybe Mark is a deeper person than we realize. Maybe he's a lot smarter than he lets on.
Yeah.
Possible?
Very possible.
Definitely possible. So 9:30, Christy's mother calls and claims, this is very weird, wants to speak to Christy. And Mark says that she's sleeping, even though she's right there. And this is why I didn't really understand the reason for, you put this in your notes, the reason why Mark told Christy's mother that she was sleeping and not missing was why?
That she didn't feel real good.
Now, does he mean the mother, like Christy's mother didn't feel well? Or
no, Christy didn't. That's why he didn't put her on the phone.
Weird. But he claims to not want to worry her, so he just says, leave me alone, mom. You know, stepmom.
Yeah, like, it's fine.
Without any warning, Mark kind of scoops up his kids, goes to Christy's grandmother, Christy's mother's house, I think, or grandmother.
Grandmother, yeah.
To drop off the kids. Now, normally this would not be a big deal, but she even said that normally you ask, it's not like don't just show up and drop these kids off, but that's what he did. At 11:30, he allegedly drove around for
2 hours.
Yeah. 2 hours. But no, nobody went with him. He didn't speak to anybody. There are no witnesses to really attach themselves to this particular search. A few hours later, I'm not sure what time.
Mark, there was no specified time.
But Mark reports Christy missing to police. Now, within 48 hours of Christy going missing, Mark decides the perfect time to move out of their house, like we said, boxed up all of her clothes, and he just sold both of their cars. It's crazy.
Not suspicious.
No. I wouldn't mind. I mean, I don't know what kind of cars these are, but I'm going to guess he took bottom dollar. You know, if you just want to get rid of them.
Yeah.
And that's it. Like, that's kind of like where the case kind of goes cold for Unsolved Mysteries for the most part. We don't have any information. Or did you happen to find anything that happened between then and then 3 months later?
I found nothing between that time and March.
Yeah, I can't even find an article to talk about it. This was a forgotten case. Christy's suitcase was found 3 months later at a roadside area 30 miles away. Out of nowhere. Yes. It seemed the police said that it looks as though it was deliberately placed. My devil's advocate. If Mark had done this, two things. Why do this? Why dump the case?
Yeah.
And two, why not just burn it?
Yeah.
I mean, nobody's looking for anything, right? I mean, it doesn't seem that anything is happening. Somebody had that case physically, dumped it. I mean, the whole thing seems so shady.
It does.
And it just makes me think that it's possible Mark did not do this. I mean, I'm not really sure. So,
yeah.
No other traces were ever found of her except for this case. Also, in the case was exactly what Mark claimed that there would be in that case. You know, right down to, her favorite jeans and that type of thing. So despite a search of the area around Gothenburg, no other trace has ever been found. And this case is now stalled. I mean, there's not too much. You did a bit of information that I found interesting is that even though the case is still open, it still receives a few leads a year, but I couldn't find very much.
Yeah, no, that article said something about, but I also did some research at the same time and no, couldn't find anything.
It's kind of interesting. So
yeah,
I found Mark on Facebook. It looks as though his two children, he actually has two daughters. It's another thing that Unsolved Mysteries didn't report correctly, but I think that these things are hints.
Oh, they said a son in the, so they were incorrect.
Well, I feel like my theory is that Unsolved Mysteries puts out incorrect information on purpose so that it could be like if they get a call about it, say, well, look, if you know the family, then you'll know what we reported incorrectly. And it's kind of like a tell, like, well, no, they have a son and a daughter. It's like, well, no, that's false, And they'll know me because this happens so often that Unsolved Mysteries gets it wrong. I find something in at least one episode, each episode. So I don't know that for sure, but it would be a good idea because they probably get tips from a lot of like wackos all the time.
Yeah.
Or had, back when this aired in 1988. But yeah, as of right now, Mark has not been brought up on any charges.
No.
Christy Jo Nichols never showed up. Property values are very affordable in the
very, very
in the small town of Gothenburg,
which is still a very small town and only has, as of 2010, only grew by 574 people.
Now, I would imagine this would be a great town for goth. No, bad joke, bad fun. All right, so where do you live? Gothenburg. It's German and goth. Whoa. So Gail Delano, this is a small little update on a previous case. I'm not familiar with this case. Did you ever see the original by any chance?
I did, actually.
Okay. I think it's one of these things we could deep dive in the future, but this is to update the story of Gail Delano from Brunswick, Maine. They claim it's solved. She answered a personal ad. She put out a personal ad for...
Yeah, she was the divorced mother of two teenage boys.
Mm-hmm.
And she, put out an ad, a personal ad, and she was supposed to meet someone at a restaurant, but that's...
Yeah, we're not really sure. Whole thing seems so weird that somebody who... I'll just say what they claim to have happened. They claim that she went to this... location, she parked her car, she hid her keys, she discarded her purse, she flew to Mobile, Alabama.
Yeah.
Checked into a hotel.
After Jackie Stafford, rather. Stafford.
And
alias.
And committed suicide by drug overdose, leaving behind two children. They say this, I don't know. To me, this seems like such a sketchy story. I mean, it's hard. They say it's solved. I say it's sketchy. I don't know. Why put out a personal ad if you're not looking for the future? Most people who are looking towards the future don't put out personal ads wanting to meet somebody new.
Yes.
So who knows? Maybe she met somebody and that person killed her. But yeah, that's from... she vanished on June 22nd, 1986. But yeah, it's solved. We can just move on to the next thing where I think this is the one that you were most excited about talking about, the San Quentin.
This one was
situation.
Fun to research. I actually really enjoyed watching this segment. I've seen this one before. So it was, of course, as I said, this was the episode of All the Marks. And we had an escaped convict from San Quentin named Mark Adams, who escaped in the summer of 1986.
Mm-hmm. I'll give you the mic on this one. Okay. If you don't mind, I'll jump in. We're still feeling out each other. No, we're not feeling out anything. Yes. You know what I mean? Like, we're still learning how our rhythm works. And, I tend to be a chatty, chatty, chatty. So always feel free to... jump in and talk. You know about this case a bit more than I do, so please, the microphone is yours.
All right. So, this case, at the beginning of the actual segment, which I think was probably the longest segment on the episode, they did a little history on San Quentin. It opened in July 1852, not 1952, 1852.
Yeah.
And it was called The Arena by the prisoners. Sounds like a movie. Is the oldest prison in California. Johnny Cash at San Quentin was recorded on February 24th, 1969.
Are you familiar with that album by any chance?
I've heard of it, yes, absolutely.
You gotta listen to it straight through, just because...
It's that good, huh?
Well, it's I'm gonna say it's a top 50 album for me. It's not like a top 10 or anything.
Yes, absolutely.
But it's so fun to listen to because, while he's recording it and everything... He's talking to the prisoners.
Yes.
And there's announcements. You hear like, such and such come to the yard or something like that. And it's...
Oh, I'm definitely going to listen to this.
And the audience is so rowdy because they're a bunch of criminals. And it's crazy. You got to... Definitely Johnny Cash at San Quentin, one of my favorite albums. It's so fun.
That's Okay, I will definitely listen to it now, knowing that, because I've heard how legendary it is, but never actually listened to it.
Also, this all, the shooting that...
The evening of August 17th, 1979, three high school students went to a municipal baseball park to drink beer and hang out. You know, normal teenage stuff.
Yeah.
Three people encountered them and demanded their wallets.
The reenactment reminded me a lot of, like, you know, it was a decent reenactment. It was like,
yeah,
Karate
it
Kid
kind
of level.
It reminded me of the Matthew McConaughey one. Like, yeah. Remember that one?
Yeah. You know what? I haven't seen that one in a while, but we'll definitely cover that one. But
let me talk about that one at another point.
But the acting is so poor in this that it's a little bit laughable, even though it's such a terrible thing that happened.
Oh, I know. I feel terrible. It's like, you feel terrible laughing at these reenactments because they're just that bad.
Yeah.
Anyway, Mike Rittenour was one of the teenagers, and he was shot to death after refusing to give his wallet. And one of the other teenagers was injured. I know there was a third one, but they don't mention what happened to the third one. So maybe he got away uninjured, you know.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it's a very... I'm going to guess they scatter. I mean, somebody pulls out a gun. I mean, it's never happened to me, but personally. But if I'm hanging out with my friends drinking beer, the last thing I'm going to do is hang out and see what happens next.
Yes. And you said in your notes, you said Unsolved Mystery sound effects really went deep. Department really went overboard with the 50 cal rounds.
Yeah, you know, I'm gonna just play a quick sound. This is not from the Unsolved Mysteries thing. This is an actual 50 caliber machine gun firing. Now, that's a real 50 caliber machine gun firing.
Yes.
And I would say that isn't even as dramatic as what Unsolved Mysteries did. Here's another version of it. Yeah, that was it. That was a little bit more like what we heard, right? I'm going to guess they didn't have a 50 caliber machine gun that would weigh like, you know, 150 pounds.
Yeah.
Firing at these poor kids who don't want to give up their, you know, $8 in their wallet.
And my beer.
We never learn how much money that they got away with, because to me, that's always very heartbreaking, is like, you were killed over $8. Just give up your wallet.
Yeah.
If you really have to, like, just... In a situation like this, you might not be so proud of the decision of giving up and just giving it, you know, giving it all away. But your life is definitely worth more than no matter how much money you have in your wallet. But yeah, I just think it is a little bit over the top. I laughed out loud when I heard that.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah.
When you pointed it out, it made it even funnier.
But the thing is the guy, the shooter who got caught, was only 16 years old at the time.
Yes, Mark Adams, the famous Mark Adams. He was sentenced to life in San Quentin.
But yeah, I've always been curious, what happens to a kid when they commit this type of heinous crime? And this article really touches upon it. I'll put this link anyway in the show notes. But being 16 years old, you know, I mean, 16 years old, you're a real dummy. But he's sentenced to life in San Quentin. Life.
Yes. So they, you know, they go into a little bit more background on the history of the famous inmates after they introduce the person. After they talk about this Mark Adams, they talk a little bit about the background and history on the famous inmates of San Quentin. So, you know, for among like those famous names, we've got this guy. So San Quentin is currently the largest death row in the nation at around 730 death row inmates. And some notable residents include Scott Peterson. Everybody remembers him. Charles Ng, Richard Allen Davis, and Lonnie Franklin, among hundreds of others.
Yeah, I don't know so much about these people. Scott Peterson, of course, we know he's kind of popular. He's got a fan club, practically. Now, you came up with an interesting factoid, though, that Mark Adams was 19 when he entered San Quentin, so I'm going to guess he was in some type of juvenile detention center before that, but I couldn't find anything.
Yeah, I couldn't find anything either. But yes, they did say that he was 19 when he entered, and he was eligible for parole in 2007 at that point.
Yeah, that's crazy. I mean, you go in for life and you're getting out.
That was 19. Let's see, he committed the murder when he was 16, so that was 1979. So 3 years later would be 1982. So 25 years he was eligible for parole.
Wow.
Would be at that point.
But, you know, Mark Adams became like the friend of the prison, it seemed.
All of a sudden, A model prisoner.
Yeah, and did you notice he went to go on the computer? And did you notice the computer? I'm sure your husband would like this computer as well.
I don't know if he really would like that, but I did notice it.
It's an Apple IIc.
Yes. We had one of those in when I was in school. I mean, this was in the, you know, the early 90s, but they had one of these in the classroom, one of my classes.
That's basically, I still have one of these, and I love them. They were like...
So his restrictions were relaxed after 6 months, and he was, like I said, he was described as the model prisoner. And he seized any opportunity to be out of the cell and took advantage of his position working in the prison. So on June 10th, 1986, exactly 4 years after his arrival, he secured an authorized pass to leave work early.
Mm-hmm.
So approximately 2:30, he walked through a security checkpoint and was last seen heading to the dentist's office.
That whole thing, that whole scene, if it went down like that, I
think
it's
just
crazy.
Walks right out like it's nothing.
Like, he walks out to the garden. He's like, he has like a hall pass. So he's like, I'm just going to the dentist, getting the cavity filled, you know, and he just, it's Mark. It's fine.
Yeah, I think he's good. So 4:15, he was found missing during a head count and all access was sealed off. No trace of him was found. So there were three theories. And yes, I forget what the third one was as well, but I did get
were two theories.
Yeah. So there's only two theories. So he was wearing civilian clothing and leaving with other visitors.
Oh, I know the third one is. It'll be a surprise after you finish talking. I remembered.
Yes. And then scaling the wall was one of the other theories.
I think that it was he escaped in the garbage truck. Remember, they had a dumpster and they had garbage removal.
Is that what they mentioned, or is that just your theory?
It's kind of my theory because I they might have mentioned it, but they said that they have hundreds of cars that come in and out throughout the entire day.
Yeah.
So I think if he went into the dumpster or hid on the garbage truck somewhere, he could have escaped. That's what I think. If he's a lefty like I am, that's what he did. A Mark lefty, that's dangerous. A lefty Mark is very, very dangerous.
From the actual original airing, it said 2 years later there hadn't been a trace of him. But an update, and you know, I love these updates.
Yeah.
Update. It said after 7 years, so about 1993, Mark Adams was captured in, of all places, Puerto Rico. So he got out of San Quentin and went all the way to Puerto Rico. And he was returned to San Quentin.
But for 7 years, he was like in Puerto Rico, hanging out, you know, just, it's weird because we have another story coming up where somebody was captured outside of the country as well in a similar type of place. So I thought it was kind of weird, but yeah, he was returned. Now, this is where things get a little bit crazy is that on March 7th, 1994, following an assault on a fellow inmate, Adams was shot and killed by correctional officer Timothy Scott Reynolds.
Yes.
Now that's a lot of people might say, well, that's a happy ending, right? The guy's a murderer, you know, but you know, at the same time, correctional officers should not really be shooting people to death.
Yes.
Now the girlfriend of Timothy Scott Reynolds, the correctional officer, the girlfriend stated that he bragged that he had killed the inmate, and I guess it was being used as bragging rights because Adams was featured on America's Most Wanted.
Yes.
And recaptured. His former girlfriend never tried to, you know, cross a woman. That's what I say. But actually testified against Mr. Reynolds, which is crazy. Adams' family sued San Quentin, and a federal jury awarded the Adams family, or whoever might have gotten it, $2.3 million for the fatal shooting by Timothy Scott Reynolds. I could not find Timothy Scott Reynolds today. I don't know where he is. I'm going to guess he lost his job as correctional officer.
Oh, yeah.
But how did Mark ever escape? We don't know.
We don't know. And it's the secret that he took with him. But your theory.
Well, my theory is simple. I do think he bribed a guard.
Yeah.
He got like a little baggie of clothing, changed the clothes, and he snuck out. But he might have done the other thing where he becomes dumpster trash for a moment, and he goes out that way. I mean, it's a really crazy thing. He somehow evaded the police for 7 years. I mean, that's...
It's amazing how he managed to do that. It's like, did he change his name? Did he change his identity? Like, or like his, his appearance or...
Well, unfortunately, they didn't have the software that they had for our next case.
Yes.
Because that's amazing stuff. And I'm sure that your mind was blown. You probably thought that they used the Apple II to do this computer animation that they were showing us.
I probably did. I like the computer. I like this enhancement that they did for this. It was very interesting.
Only thing missing was like little computer sounds like bloop, bloop.
Yes.
Bloop. You know, that would have been really nice. So, all right, we're going back, way back in time again, 1984. It's September 24th.
Stephen Cox case, or the Medford Millions.
What a tough name to grow up with. But just have. But he must have loved his name because he named his business after it.
So yes.
The S.D. Cox Investment.
Yes.
So I'm going to just catch us up to the basics of the case, and then we'll get to where things started getting really bad. So,
yes.
Stephen Cox was, from what I can tell, an investment person. You would give him money, he would invest it, and you reap the rewards of these investments. He made a promise of 20 to 25% return. This is incredible stuff. This is also 1984. The economy is doing kind of okay.
So,
So, I mean, things are interesting, you know. His business, I think that it's a legit business at this point. I have to say, Stephen Cox, I think, started out legit. He starts investing in other things, and then it doubles, it triples. He brings on his...
A restaurant, a neighborhood bar, a video arcade, two jewelry stores with an inventory of gems worth hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, I mean, the guy is making, from what we would look, wow, this is really interesting. He's paying interest to everybody. He's bringing in new investors.
Yes.
The guy is living the life. He even brought on Bud, Eugene Bud Richmond, a partner.
An interesting character. Am I right?
This guy, I want to say something about Lorraine.
I like her. She says what she's thinking. She says it best. She goes, well, Eugene Richmond is a liar. He never did. Never told us. Not me. Never told me.
You know, this is what everyone's going to say. When it all hits the fan, you're going to say, well, nobody told me. It's like, well, it's really, if it's your money and you care about it and you can't afford to lose it, it should be in writing. You know, I don't like this whole like, well, it's their fault. It's kind of your fault because you signed that check, you know? So I don't think that the investors are completely without fault. They might have made poor choices. They might have been targeted because these are, you know, older people from what I can tell. But at the same time, be more careful with your money and who you're giving it to. But at the same time, like I said before, S.D. Cox Investments seem to be a legitimate situation. This all reminds me of Bernie Madoff, which, of course, he bilked millions of dollars from some of the smartest people in the world. So the best get taken, but at the same time, you just have to be careful.
Yeah, exactly.
So what happened?
That's why Bernie Madoff, absolutely.
I think what happened is Stephen Cox's business started turning into a pyramid scheme. And most people probably know what a pyramid scheme, but essentially it just means if you aren't getting new investors, you're not getting any new money.
Yes.
And that's the problem. Eugene goes to Lorraine Rondeau to talk her into investing her last $5,000.
He's a forceful personality in the partnership.
Yeah, he's the guy who can sell you the car with the leather. And then it's like, well, I'm a vegan, you know? So, yeah, I mean, he's definitely pushy. You know what? As a car salesman and as maybe a realtor, he would do very well. But in this situation, he's taking the life savings of people and he's basically stealing it. But at this point, maybe even he wasn't aware of the entire scheme. One person that gets mentioned a little bit later, but we don't get any details on, is Steve's wife.
Yes.
This is a character that I don't know exactly, but I do know that she ratted Steve out at the end.
She did. Yes.
Very interesting. Essentially, I don't know exactly what happened to make them freak out. But Richmond told the employees on September 21st that him and Steve Cox are going to go out of town throughout Monday and return on Tuesday.
Yes.
But that weekend, do you want to talk about what they ended up doing?
That weekend, they cleaned out the safe in the office. They took the jewelry and the financial records. Steve Cox and his wife emptied their house and packed everything into a rental truck, and the three left for their final destination.
Where's Hawaii. That? So the whole thing is so shady. I mean, they basically, in the reenactment, they're going into the jewelry store and they're grabbing up all the jewels and they're doing all this stuff. They're just up and leaving. They're just cashing out.
I just scrolled down through the notes and you have the picture of the hula girl.
Yeah. But you know, what I think is so weird about this is there have to be more people involved. Very shady people. Because
it seems like it, yeah.
You don't just take several pounds of jewelry, all this cash, and get on a plane and go to Hawaii and be able to use it in a meaningful way. You know, you yes. can spend a few thousand dollars here and there, even in the 80s, but we're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars. This mm-hmm. is money that I've no doubt needed to be laundered.
Yeah.
So they call this segment Medford Millions. I don't really know how many millions we're talking about when it really comes down to it.
But I said it's over 200 people that they scammed.
Wow. So, I mean, maybe, you know, say like $10 million or something. It's 80s money. That's tremendous. I mean, even now it's tremendous. Yeah. But at some point, something bad must have happened.
Yeah. After they fled with the Medford Millions, this was 10 months later, Cox's wife, Deborah, returned to Medford and cooperated with the authorities, as did Eugene Richmond. And he did tell authorities that Cox met with an investor who had taken out a life insurance policy as security for his investments.
Now, that scared me a little bit.
That scared me too.
It's like,
why?
Yeah, it's like, Allison, I'm going to take out a $500,000 life insurance policy on your life.
Yeah.
Because I'm lending you $50,000.
Yeah. Like,
well, now you're worth more to me dead. You know?
Yeah.
So I did send that over, actually, if you could just sign that. No. So,
no, but signed, sealed, and delivered.
But think about that. You know, if you're going to take out an insurance policy on somebody, they're definitely worth more to you dead. And it's definitely more stable money if you're dead. Like yeah. you know. But it's very crazy. Eugene folded like a cheap suit. Eugene Richmond pled guilty to racketeering and served two years in prison.
But Cox was still on the run. So he did his time, and Cox was still not, you know, found.
But Lorraine Rondeau has some, you know, she's like, give me that microphone.
Yeah, she's a fun one. She's like, turn yourself in and face up to the people that he's really hurt.
Yeah, it's... Calm it down, Lorraine. I'm sorry you're not getting your money back. I mean, it's terrible. I think she started with $100,000 that was left to her from her husband who had passed away, an insurance policy. I mean, that money definitely could have sustained her for her life.
Oh, definitely, yes.
And it's just, it's a very sad thing when you hear these stories, because Lorraine would have to turn to maybe family or, you know, be on an extremely low fixed income all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, taking that cruise. She could have afforded to take the cruise and relax and enjoy the later years of her life.
I couldn't find her golden years.
I couldn't find out any information about when the recreations of what Mr. Cox looks like is kind of hilarious.
Yes. And after they describe, of course, height, weight, how he may be disguised. And then this is where we go into that whole digital recreation. It was very interesting.
Like, here's Stephen Cox possibly wearing a toupee. It's like, I can imagine this without the picture. But
yes. And then the facial hair.
Yeah. Perhaps he grew a mustache. Maybe he didn't. I don't know. Maybe he's Amish and he just has the beard without the mustache. Where's that one? I don't know. These reenactments are really kind of funny to look at. But again, we're talking about such a serious thing that I don't mean to laugh. I'm more like laughing at the technology than I am laughing at the situation. But Stephen Cox was on the run for a long time.
He was.
But thanks to either a hotel manager or a maid or both.
She was a manager.
But I found information stating that it was a maid. So it's a little bit conflicted there, too.
We can't get a straight answer on anything.
So he was arrested in Lake Mead, Nevada, 5 days after fleeing Boise and registering himself in Lake Mead under a different name at this hotel. The name that he used was John Strauss, and he had an Arizona address. I believe, I can't remember the name of the town that it said on the ID. He said he was said not to be a normal guest. He only left at night. And then on one instance, he left a room during the day to empty his trash. The hotel manager or maid, we don't know what she is.
Well, no, I don't know if it's Elaine Reed. It's just weird. I found, I'll tell you the information I found, but you know, you can continue with your stuff.
Okay. So found a crumpled letter in the trash regarding the Unsolved Mysteries episode. And said when he was apprehended, the small fortune, jewelry, baseball cards, gold coins, and silver coins were all found on him.
Now, what is she doing going through the trash?
Yes.
I mean, all right, you know, the guy's guilty. I'm glad he got caught. But if I throw something out, I don't know. I shouldn't have to burn it if I'm in a hotel.
Maybe she saw the Unsolved Mysteries episode and said, oh, I think it's him. And did you notice he had a goatee when he got arrested? So that wasn't even in the recreation. They did the beard.
Oh, he didn't look anything like those recreations. No. But according to what I found, a discarded letter that aroused a maid's suspicion led to the arrest of a fugitive from Oregon. We don't know if it was because she saw the case or anything like that, but this all led to him being found guilty of all charges. And it's like, you think that he's going to go away forever. And in fact, he was sentenced to 20 years in prison, but he was released on parole after serving only 3 years.
Wonderful.
But this would not be the last time that we heard of Mr. Cox.
I've seen the notes.
He was arrested again in 2005 in Idaho on charges of grand theft, forgery, computer crime. Maybe he should have upgraded from the Apple II. And, and a parole violation. As of right now, Stephen Cox is a free man. He was released from prison. According to our legal system, he's done his time. And I'm just kind of curious what he's up to now. I do feel bad. I hope he has trouble sleeping at night because he did ruin many people's lives.
Yeah, I feel so bad for those investors. It's shame. He scammed over 200 people. And it's just, it's sad. It's really sad.
Yeah, this is the worst story of them all, though, this next one.
I think so. Worse than the San Quentin one.
This one, the way this was reported was very uncharacteristic, I guess, of Unsolved Mysteries. It seemed more like a newscast at this point.
The disclaimer that they say otherwise. Well, yeah, this definitely.
I mean, I just read in the beginning, this is not a newscast, but this is called The Cardboard Killer, and this takes place in the middle of summer, July 12th, 1988, in Philadelphia.
Yes, Northeast Section, which, as I'm also very well aware, is a very safe area. Still is a very safe area.
Oh, is it? I'm not familiar with it too much.
You don't hear much about Northeast Philadelphia and, like, Center City, Old City, Society Hill, that area. You don't hear anything about those areas. So most of, you know, what you hear mostly happens in, like, because I, you know, live in the Philadelphia media market, and usually you hear about, like, about South Philly, North Philly, but Northeast is very much a middle class area.
Okay. So something like this is very not typical, maybe, of the area.
Yes.
But a 4-year-old Barbara Jean Horn went missing. Her father was home with her, but she was outside playing. I don't want to be the person who says it. I don't think it even really needs to be said. But as a parent, I feel like I have to. A 4-year-old should not be playing outside alone.
As a non-parent, I agree 100% with you.
Right. This is sadly one of these cautionary tales. And this is the worst. I mean, this is one of these stories that is... it's a cold case, just to let everyone know. It's a very dark case. It involves a child death. So, you know, if you're sensitive to that, you shouldn't listen anymore. Sharon and John Fahey are the parents of Barbara Jean, and she does go missing. Her father and neighbors are searching for her, but she's found a few hours later.
Yeah, she was found in a cardboard box 2 blocks from her house. A man was seen carrying a box near St. Vincent and Castor. and was described as 25 to 35 years old, white male, about 5'8", 180 pounds, very specific.
Yeah.
With sandy brown hair. The box he was carrying, which she was found in, was a Hitachi 13-inch television box.
Now, that's a small box. I mean, I don't know the exact dimensions, but a 13-inch TV, a 1 foot by 1 foot cube, really.
Yeah, I had a 13-inch TV when I was a teenager, and yeah, they're not big, and the box... You know, they put for all the packing material makes it slightly bigger, but
there was an update to the case. And there was. You think that it's going to go one way. I don't want to go too much into the update because the update ended up being incorrect. You feel as though there's somebody caught, and that we can be happy for. There's justice. But Walter Ograb was found guilty of her murder and sentenced to death. This is where things get a little bit weird. He broke down and confessed to her killing in 1992. So he confessed legitimately. But yeah. I think it's worth noting that he, after this, he consistently maintained his innocence. His first trial ended in a mistrial when one of the 12 jurors who had voted to acquit changed his mind. Before the second trial, prosecutors engaged the assistance of a notorious jailhouse informant named John Hall. And they worked together to fabricate a confession from Ograb.
Yes.
The testimony, along with a false confession elicited after 14 hours of interrogation by homicide detectives who had coerced false confessions in several other cases. And therefore, Ograb was sent to death row.
Yeah, parts of the confession were able to confirm, but it was 32 years later that Walter Ograb would be found innocent, as conflicting evidence and male DNA found on Horn's body did not match. So it took like the evolution of DNA technology of identifying DNA to really like bring this case back to light. So it didn't match.
They did find male DNA on the child, but it was not Ograb's.
They did, yes. And actually, this just came back into prominence last year.
Yeah, this was last summer. Well,
it was supposed to be March. It was supposed to be March, but because of the pandemic, this was right around this time last year that they had to postpone his case because of, so they did bring him in June, and he was exonerated on June 10th.
When you look at the case and everything, it's kind of crazy. They did it quickly because of all the riots that were going on at the time
in
the Philadelphia area. I'm glad that he's exonerated, being that none of the evidence linked him to it, and he was coerced to say he killed this poor child. And but sadly, the Barbara Jean Horn case is unsolved to this day. And we think it's going to be a happy note, Allison. But nope. It's
we found ends on the town.
Yeah, we found definitely that it was definitely a sad note. I would love to see something come out about this, but as of right now, unsolved.
But for him, I mean, it's, he's going to live with this for the rest of his life. He, but at least it's known that he didn't do this.
Yeah. I couldn't find much information about the parents. I think they kind of went underground, so I don't know what they're up to. But, But Allison, I want to thank you so much for getting together for this episode of Unsolved Mysteries Rewind.
Oh, you're welcome. It was fun.
I appreciate all the work that you put into the research, and I look forward to the next one.
Tonight, we have been confronted with an entire catalog of unexplained and unsolved events. Tune in next time as Unsolved Mysteries Rewind discusses another collection of unsolved mysteries. Until then, we can only look and love it.